Cause like a winter tonight, I thought I would always have light. The quick flash that you gave to me, so dark I could barely see.
Welcome everyone, thank you for joining us. We have a fabulous show. Today we're going to be exploring Islam perspectives, different views, what they believe. We have Imam Mustafa with us. He is the Director of Education and Outreach of the Islamic Institute of Orange County. Welcome to the circle, Imam.
Thanks for having me.
Today I wanted to explore all over the place. We're going to kind of bounce around. So the first thing I thought was really interesting when we met a few weeks ago was how does Islam view certain characters that we have in the Bible? And one of them, I won't start off with Jesus quite yet. Let's go with Noah. I was really surprised to know even Noah is even in the Quran.
Yes.
So tell us, what does it say about Noah?
So about Noah, it mentions the stories which are very similar to the Bible in terms of that there was a flood and Noah was calling his people to God. His people were kind of transgressing. They started worshiping idols. And this is something which I'm not sure if it's mentioned in the Bible or not, but Islam really puts a lot of emphasis on monotheism. And that all prophets were teaching this idea of monotheism. So Noah came to his people, and he saw them, they were worshipping idols, and he stayed with them for, you know, hundreds of years, for a very long time, and he was calling them, and they weren't, you know, responding. So then finally, God decided, you know what, we're going to go ahead, and we're going to wipe these people out, and we're going to replace them with another generation. Now, the idea of the flood being universal, though, is something that you don't find in the Quran. Right, so it's simply talking about Noah's people. There's no evidence that it's actually something that wiped out the entire world. So this is quite different. You find a lot of, you know, Christians having to kind of go up against scientists and say, well, how could the flood doesn't seem to be universal? That conception is not there in the Quran. And it's not an idea that, you know, God is destroying the entire world because he's upset with all of them, even though Noah was only talking to a small group of people. But this is something that we generally don't have to face, you know. But there's an entire chapter of the Quran called Noah, actually, and the story of Noah is mentioned in more than just one place in the Quran, so it's really interesting.
That's very fascinating. And now you led me to another question. Creation. What is Islam's view of how this universe became?
So the idea of creation is that, you know, basically God created everything. It doesn't explain in detail how exactly he did it and what was the process and, you know, what came first and what happened here and what happened there. So it's something that, you know, we can get into in terms of more like on a scientific debate or trying to look at the philosophy of how things happen and all of that. But it simply says that God created the world in six, you know, stages rather than 6 days. Oh. So the thing is, the word day in the sight of God is used in a different sense. So it says one day in the Quran, it says one day in the sight of God is like 50,000 years. Or one day in the sight of God is like 100,000 years.
So he's out of the domain of time.
He's out of the domain of time, exactly. Oh. So this idea of like 6 firm days of 24-hour periods doesn't exist, because the idea of a 24-hour period is when, you know, that's, you know, the sun and the earth and the rotation, that didn't even exist when he was creating in the beginning. So we don't even go and say, oh, we're talking about 24-hour days, right? So that concept is not, it doesn't really become an issue in Islam or in the Quran when we're analyzing those verses.
So Islam and evolution don't have to, they can reconcile themselves. They can be okay with each other?
They pretty much can. It's the idea of randomness or chance coincidence in evolution, which is the problem. But the idea of the evolution in and of itself just taking place, or modifications or change or in species or whatever it is, there's no issue with that in Islam.
It could be just an expression of God or how he decided to do it.
How he decided to do it, exactly.
Or she, I guess. Yeah. Does God have a gender?
So here's the interesting thing. That's a good question. Does God have a gender? So the interesting thing is that in Semitic languages, Arabic, Hebrew, all of these things, there is no neuter in the language. Everything is he or she. There's no it. So it doesn't exist. There's no word. So interestingly, in Arabic, the word for sun is shams, and it's feminine. The word for moon is qamar, and it's masculine. It doesn't mean that the Arabs thought that the moon, sun was somehow feminine or something like that. So you just have to pick one. And whenever you default to something, you default to the male, because that's just considered to be, that can apply for both male or female. In a group. It's a really deep grammatical concept, but the default becomes masculine, and the feminine is an exception. Generally, in terms of objects, things which are not people, right? So this is what generally what happens. So God defaulted to masculine, even though he's supposed to be neuter, because he's neither male nor female, right? He's beyond creation, right? So the thing is, if there was a... We're so used to translating God as he in English. A real translation, if you want it to be really accurate, we'd say it. But it just sounds weird, right? It's in English. It doesn't sound right. But technically, God is not neither male nor female.
Interesting. Really fascinating stuff. So... Well, let's go back to another character here before I get into more questions. I have so many for him. Abraham.
Yes.
He's the big man, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He transcends three traditional faiths, the Judeo-Christian faith as well as Islam.
Absolutely.
So how does Islam view Abraham?
Every single one of the five prayers that we perform on a daily basis, we actually mention Abraham in the prayer.
In each one of them?
In each and every single one of the prayers. Because Abraham goes up, there's an entire chapter of the Quran named after Abraham. It's named Abraham. And he's like the spiritual grandfather of the lineage of Islam. So, like you said, of the other religions, but we believe in Jesus, we believe in Moses, we believe in all of them. And the difference between Muhammad and the difference between the prophets which are coming from the children of Israel, like Moses and Jesus and David and Solomon, is that they're coming from the two children of Abraham. So one line is Ishmael and one line is Isaac. So what's happening is Muhammad is coming from the lineage of Ishmael, and all the other ones are coming from the lineage or the bloodline of Isaac.
That's Sarah and Hagar?
Yeah, Sarah and Hagar, okay. Exactly. So this is what happened, and their father is Abraham. So what's happening is there's kind of been this racial split along the lines between Arabs and the children of Israel and their lineage and all that. And what Islam is saying, if we're going to have this issue, let's go back and say, what was Abraham following, right? What was his religion and what way did he follow? And that's what Islam is telling us, is go back to the original source. If you have like some issue going on here, just take it one generation back. Who was Abraham? What was he doing? And we get the entire story in detail in the Quran about who is Abraham, who is this guy. It talks about how when he was a kid, he started questioning his own people and saying, you know what, you know, his father was an idol maker, not only an idol worshiper, but he was one of the people who was making the idols.
Abraham's father,
right? And he's making the idols and he's going and, you know, he's one of the high priests or whatever it is. And he's questioning his own father as a young person, saying, you know what, how can we worship, you know, the statue, which, you know, doesn't even, you're putting food in front of the statue and it doesn't even eat the food. And, you know, what is this, you know? So it's showing Abraham his critical thinking skills, that he was a very, you know, righteous person, a very intelligent person when he was young. And then what happened was when he, you know, received revelation, he became a messenger of God, he was persecuted by his people. There was a king, Nimrod, tried to, you know, burn him alive, tried to have him killed. He escaped, you know, and he managed to leave the area, and then he started, you know, worshiping only God. And Abraham is a very important figure, because in Islam, the holiest city in Islam is Mecca, which is in Arabia. And the reason why it's so special and so holy is because there's this building called the Kaaba, which is that little, you know, cubic building. You find it actually has a black cover around it. Very, very small little building. That's the direction in which all Muslims pray around the entire world. They pray in that direction.
Of this building.
Now, not praying to the building, but they're praying in the direction of the building for unity purposes. What's in the building? Nothing.
Nothing?
It's nothing. Completely empty. It's just an empty building. So why pray to it? Because we believe that Abraham built this building to dedicate to the worship of God. There's so many different temples for idols. There's so many different temples for this God and for that God. And he said, you know, we need to build something for the worship of the one God, you know, the creator of everything. But what should it look like? It's not supposed to be fancy. It's supposed to be really simple. And it's literally just an empty building. It's just like a symbol that, you know what, this is a symbol that we're just going to be united in this direction. And this is, we couldn't call this the house of God. Not in the, you know, not in the sense that God is dwelling inside or something like that. Not in the anthropomorphic sense. But in the sense that this is the place of God. This is something that we should dedicate ourselves to. So every single time a Muslim goes to Mecca, or they go on this pilgrimage for Hajj, you know, once in their lifetime or whatever it is, they're actually commemorating Abraham. Everything that they do, it commemorates Abraham. In the prayer, they mention Abraham. It comes back saying, you know what, the spiritual lineage of Muhammad is the same as what Abraham was actually teaching.
Interesting. Well, we have two more. Next, Mary.
Yes.
That was really a surprise for me. I did not understand. I did not know that Islam believed in Mary.
Yes. So this is interesting. There's actually an entire chapter of the Quran called Mary as well. So there's an entire chapter about her. And it's a really interesting chapter. If anyone, you know, checks out a translation of the Quran, I recommend that they read it. Or if they were to hear the recitation in Arabic, it's one of, for me, it's one of the most beautiful, you know, chapters in the Quran when it's recited. It rhymes and has just a very nice flow to it. But yeah, there's an entire chapter about the mother of Jesus, right? So we believe that Jesus is a prophet and a messenger of God, and one of the greatest, actually. He's counted as one of the top five prophets that have ever lived. The top five are Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad. So he's in the top five. Yeah, so he's definitely up there. There's 25 prophets mentioned in the Quran, and about 20 of them are mentioned in the Bible as well. So they're overlap.
There's five that are not.
Five that are not.
Oh, who are they?
They're mainly Arab prophets. So Muhammad is one that's not mentioned in the Bible directly. We believe that he has some connotation there. There's Hud or Eber. He might be mentioned and he may not. Saleh, and who else? Zulkifl, and there's one more.
That's
all right. There's a few of them.
Some homework for you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's interesting.
But yeah, Mary is a very important figure in Islam. She's considered one of the role models for all women in Islam. And that's why, you know, sometimes when people, you know, ask, they say, well, why do you Muslim women, you know, why do they wear that scarf and that veil and everything?
The hijab,
exactly. And one of the things I tell them, I say, you know, have you ever seen a picture or a statue of Mary? And they say, yeah, it's in the church. I said, what did her hair look like? He said, I don't know, because she was wearing a veil. I said, exactly. We're trying to follow Mary. So she was doing the exact same thing, right? So this is something that's
the real reason behind the hijab.
It's not just because she was doing but it kind of shows that these spiritual values, these moral values of like modesty and decency of covering up, there's something that go and transcend just the community of Muhammad. They go back to time of Jesus. Mm-hmm. They go back to Mary. They go back to Prophet Abraham, perhaps, you know. So they go all the way back, and Mary is seen as like a role model for each and every single person. Everyone has to love Mary. Everyone has to love Jesus. Everyone has to respect both of them. You know, so it's really interesting. I taught a class in our college about the prophets. Just all the prophets besides Muhammad that are mentioned in the Quran. So we did a statistical analysis. We did a count of all the words in the Quran, an account of all the words that mention prophets. And we found that it was about 10%. So about 10% of the Quran is just talking about prophets besides Muhammad. And most of the prophets are mentioned in the Quran, in the Bible as well. It's very interesting.
It is very fascinating.
Hi, welcome to Adelante. This is Adelante Recovery, and my name is Yvette Kuglin, and I'm part of the staff.
Adelante Recovery Center has helped people in dual diagnosis for 5 years. We accept most PPO insurances and provide luxury accommodations and 24-hour support. To speak with an admissions counselor, call 1-888-242-4450.
A lot of time, we don't even know what's wrong with us, and sometimes we need to get away to figure that out. So if you want to go for a little retreat out in Corona Del Mar, which is a confidential location, we're here to help. So we're only a phone call away. Thank you.
A quick question on the hijab.
Sure.
What is the proper way to wear it? We've seen some distinctions over the last few years.
Mm.
Some of them wear it just here, covering their hair. Some of them cover it all the way up to their eyes.
Right.
I've heard some people say, you're not supposed to do that. That's not in the Quran. What is the truth?
So pretty much the hijab is supposed to be, according to the vast majority of scholars, you cover up your hair, you cover up this area. You make sure that all the parts are covered except your face, so that you can see, you can breathe and everything. Your hands.
Your hands are covered as well.
No, your hands are not covered. Your hands are can be exposed, and your feet as well. All right, so these are the parts that you kind of need to, you know, move around and all of that. Everything else should be covered and it should be loose, in the sense that it should not be really, really tight. So if you're showing, like, if you're wearing, like, you know, spandex or something over here, it's going to be really tight. So it's supposed to be loose clothing. There's three principles of hijab, basically. One is that all these parts, which are considered, you know, beautification parts, except the face, the hands, and the feet, should be covered. The second is that the clothing should be loose, so that it's not revealing. And the third is that it should not be transparent. Right? It's pretty simple. This is the principles of Islam. This idea of covering the face and all of that, there are some Muslim scholars who try to justify it religiously. And they said, no, it's part of the religion, it's part of the modesty or something like that. And, you know, they're entitled to their opinion. But they can't dispute that the vast majority of Muslim scholars, early and late, have always said that that's not a requirement. It's not a requirement. So it's something, if you wanted to do that, and if women want to do that, you know, I can respect that. And if they choose that, you know, they choose to do that, they can go ahead and do that. But so, like, sometimes you find that some things people do more out of culture than out of religion. And you may interpret them as thinking they're doing it out of religion, but they're actually doing it out of culture. Like, for example, the color black, right? So if you look at most of the women who cover their face, they're usually wearing black. Mm-hmm. So why black? And like Saudi men are wearing white, and the women are wearing black. So what's with this white and black thing, right? It's purely culture. And if you ask them, they'll say, yeah, it's culture. So we could wear white, we could wear blue, we could wear whatever color it is, but they choose to wear that. And what ends up happening, I think people have this conception that, you know, oh, they're this or they're that or they're doing for... When I was a kid, when I first went to Arabia, I'm like, these are like ninjas. You know, they're covering their face, they're wearing black. Ninjas. You know, that's the first thing I thought when I was a kid, you know. But that's part of their culture. But, you know, from the religious perspective, this is what needs to be covered. The face can be uncovered, the hands can be uncovered, the feet can be uncovered. And, you know, you can get around, you can drive, you can do this, all these things.
From a psychological analysis, I think I found out why he's in the martial arts. Anyway, we're going to move on from that. We're going to try to briefly find out how do we get to paradise. Mm. And then I wanted to take you into a little different world. Right now the hot topic, and it's unfortunate, but it is racism. Mm. We have the Ferguson incident. And a lot of people believe racism is dead in America. Mm-hmm. It's far from it, in my opinion. But before we get to that, first, how do we get to paradise?
Right. So the idea of in Islam about how to get to paradise is two things. It's number one is fulfilling the rights of the Creator and fulfilling the rights of the creation. Right. And this is manifested in the Quran by saying those who believe and do good deeds. And you see this recurring theme in the Quran. If you believe and if you do good deeds, then everything's going to be fine.
Believe in.
So that's what does it mean by belief? So believe in Allah, believe in God. The way that he's supposed to be believed in, only worship him, don't worship anybody else, fulfilling his rights, right? So that meaning believing in him and worshiping him, right? Believing in the prophets that were sent, right? So all the prophets that had come from Muhammad and Jesus and Moses and believing in all of them.
Right? Believing in them as well.
Oh yeah, because believing in Muhammad entails that you believe in all the previous prophets that came as well. So you have to believe in Jesus. You have to believe in Moses. You have to believe in Noah. You have to believe in Abraham.
And believe just in their existence?
No, believe in their message as well. So the thing is, well, how do we know about their message, right? So we know about their message through the Quran. So because the Quran actually talks about them. So that's why we're believing in them, right? Mm-hmm. So not just in their existence. I'm glad you pointed that out. Because usually in today's society, when we hear believe in God, we think about believing in the existence of God. When the Quran or when Islam says believe in God, it implies a lot more than just believing in existence. It means believing in and accepting that God is the creator, accepting that God has sent prophets, and only worshiping him and actually having some kind of connection with him in the sense that you're acknowledging him as being the creator and acknowledging him on a regular basis. So yeah, this is a type of belief. Yeah.
So what is Islam's view on racism, and do you have any opinion about this Ferguson incident?
Yeah, I mean, I have not looked into it in too much detail. I've seen a lot of reports and a lot of, you know, analysis and all that. And it doesn't surprise me that there's definitely racism taking place in this incident. And, you know, when I grew up, I grew up in Orange County here. I grew up in a very, you know, mixed environment, different cultures and everything. So I was taught that, you know, racism was something of the 60s or something of the past, you know. It's not there anymore. And I actually held this naive view for a very long time until September 11th, until it started coming to me, you know. And when it started coming to me, then I started kind of waking up and I started realizing, hey, it's actually not just against me as a Muslim. The African Americans still have it. The Latinos, they still have it. And I became a little bit more aware. I think most Muslims became more aware of this after it started happening to them. Otherwise, you're kind of in your own little bubble, you know. So it's definitely alive and well. Now, what does Islam say about racism, right? first of all, the Quran talks about how all people were created from one male and one female. So all people have a common origin. What if you believe one? All people have a common origin. How can you discriminate based upon one person or another person, right? Another interesting thing, it says that the devil or the Satan, there's this story about Adam and Satan, or what we call Iblis. He was supposed to submit to God by showing respect to Adam, and he refused. And when he justified himself and said, well, I'm not going to show him any respect. I'm not going to show a human being any respect. He said, well, why not? He said, because you created me from fire. The Satan is created from fire, and the human being is created from clay. And therefore, I'm better because I'm made from fire. So what we say in Islam is the first racist ever was Satan, because he believes that he's superior because of his the composition of his body. And that's what racism is, right? Because the pigmentation in your skin is somehow different from the other person. You think you're somehow superior because of that, just because of the color of your skin or because of your makeup, your physical makeup or something like that. So Islam is very clear about breaking that apart. And in fact, there's a history. So what you find is one of the first things that Muhammad did when he received the revelation is he started freeing slaves. And among his followers were the black slaves from Ethiopia, right? The Abyssinian Empire and all of that. And when he came in, a lot of them were attracted to the message of Islam, because the first thing he was telling them is everyone is equal, like to the teeth of a comb. Everyone is equal across the board. So it doesn't matter what your makeup is. It doesn't matter what status you have in society. And people were attracted to that. And I think one of the most powerful things in Islam, which really helped remove racism completely, eliminate, even people accept Islam, sometimes you can have a thought or you can have this idea or whatever it is. The one thing that really eliminates racism in Islam is the communal prayer, which is five times a day. So what we do is when we pray, we stand in lines together, side by side in a group, right? You may have a black man leading that prayer. You may have a Latino leading that prayer, and you'll have other people in the back praying behind them. That person, if he can recite the Quran better and if he's more knowledgeable, he gets to lead the prayer. You're in the back now. There's no racial discrimination when it comes to leading the prayer. And it doesn't matter if you're a king or if you're a servant or what background you come from, you're standing side by side to the person next to you. So if you go to Arabia during the pilgrimage time, even today with all this monarchy and all this weird stuff going on, you might be standing next to the prince. Doesn't matter where you come from, and you're on equal footing. And during the pilgrimage that we have, what's called the Hajj, when you go, everyone puts on the same clothing, right? Everyone puts on the same clothing. It's like two white garments, and no one can tell who's who. Oh, you can't really? You can't tell, because you're all wearing the same clothing. You're praying side by side. No one can tell who's a king, who's a prince, who's a regular, who's a street sweeper in the city or whatever it is. You can't tell the difference. So not only is it just a theory and a concept that no, there's no racism or you shouldn't do this or something like that, it practically implemented this on a very practical level. And former slaves became some of the most important figures in Islamic history very, very early on, 1300 years ago.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much, Imam, for coming on to the show. I know. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did. Thank you for joining us. I know hopefully in the future we're going to have Imam Mustafa come back. We're hoping for a live Q&A show or maybe even a debate. That's fantastic. Thank you again. If you want to get more information from Imam Mustafa, you can look up the Islamic Institute of Orange County.
Yes.
Once again, remember our motto is simple. Wherever there's psychology involved, we are there. See you next time, everyone.